Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent the opinions of Red Table Talk Productions, iHeartMedia, or their employees. This podcast should not be used as a substitute for medical or mental health advice. Individuals are advised to seek independent medical advice, counseling, and/or therapy from a healthcare professional with respect to any medical condition, mental health issue, or health inquiry, including matters discussed on this podcast.
And part of what made it easy to believe Anna is that, well, one, she was a friend who ostensibly wasn't asking anything of me, aside from friendship. So I think had she been a man, it might have been different.
Welcome to Navigating Narcissism, Episode 1. I'm Dr. Ramani Dravasala, and a lot of you know me as Dr. Ramani. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, and I've been practicing for 20 years. And I'm also a survivor of narcissistic abuse, which is why my focus is helping survivors. I've helped thousands of people who have suffered through narcissistic abuse, and my life mission is to teach you how to recognize the red flags so you can spot a narcissist before they spot you. In this episode, we are going to hear the story of Rachel Deloach Williams and how she met con woman Anna Sorokin, better known as Anna Delvey. This story dives into manipulation and narcissism as it comes up in a friendship. When we are talking about toxic behavior, gender can really throw people off. People often let down their guard, thinking, it's a woman. It's usually men who are narcissistic. I don't need to worry. Not so fast. There are plenty of narcissistic women. And there are even certain types of narcissism, like vulnerable narcissism, where we see it sort of pretty much equal men and women. Red flags are red flags. It doesn't matter who the person is. So, Rachel, where I'd like to begin is tell me a little bit about you, where you grew up, your family, and before you got to New York.
Sure. I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm the oldest of three kids. My sister is 2 years younger. My brother is 6 years younger than me. My parents have been married since before I was born. They're both clinical psychologists. They met in graduate school. And I grew up really close with my family in a pretty small and tight-knit community. I would say I had a pretty healthy and happy childhood.
Let's use that as the jumping off place. You met Anna and there was a natural trust there and how natural it is to trust people. So talk to us about how easy it was to trust Anna in the beginning. What drew you in and how your relationship grew with her?
That's a good question. And part of that sort of willful trust came from having been raised to really ask why, not just what. So looking at people around me as a kid, you know, when somebody would be sort of bullied or somebody might act in a way I didn't understand, I think my parents really went probably above and beyond to try and help me empathize and to try and say, well, oh, you know, here are reasons why. And like, instead of poking fun, why don't you try to be a help to them? I think that carried over into my friendship with Anna, which is not to say that the friendship started from a place of pity. You know, I was drawn in by the sort of the opposite, you know, where I was very conscientious and like concerned with how my actions affected people around me. I saw that she was very bold and she said whatever she wanted and she was very direct and she was hard to predict. Having someone who was so much the opposite of the way that I was part of sort of what drew me in because it was so different from the way that I moved through the world.
So saying whatever she wants and rebranding it as being direct and being unpredictable, those are red flags. But alas, opposites can be compelling, and many toxic relationships begin when an empathic person is drawn to audacious behavior. That should really be a red flag. What made you trust her?
Up until that point, trust had been sort of a default setting for me because I had never really had someone betray my trust in a way that was so cataclysmic. I'd had very healthy relationship models. I'd had very healthy relationships. So it was counter to my intuition going into especially a friendship, to think that I needed to constantly be cynical about whether or not what somebody was presenting to me was actually truthful.
Cynical is such a tricky word. In a world full of narcissistic people, being sort of tentative and making people earn our trust, it's actually really important. And when we frame waiting for trust to be earned as cynical, it actually takes something that's wise and it makes it seem unhealthy. And I understand your default setting was trust. So how did she draw you in?
I think she made everything seem very easy. You know, at first, there were no stakes that were apparent to me. It wasn't as though she was asking me immediately to lay anything on the line aside from just have fun with me. Let's do these fun things that weren't so far outside of the realm of my normal day-to-day life. The places where I feel like I had to sort of rationalize her behavior with regard to trusting that she was good or, you know, giving her the benefit of the doubt had to do more with her behavior, like entitlement or being rude to waiters or sort of acting in a way that didn't jive with my values. And every time that started to sort of add up, like, you know, if it happened multiple times and I started to kind of question it, she seemed to always kind of connect that I was starting to pull back, and she would immediately say something to dispel, you know, that sort of distance that might be growing between us.
So entitlement and being rude to waiters, these are actually really huge warning signs, and they're great ones because they often show up early in a relationship. Toxic people will often test the waters to kind of see how much they can get away with. And then when they sense that you may be onto them, they'll often play it off as a joke or try to soften it. Pay attention to their bad behavior and don't fall for that post-bad behavior manipulation. And so the combination of your natural tendency to trust the history of the relationship, which felt like many other friendships you'd had, even though she was unaware with what she said, it almost seems like there was an awareness when she felt that you were noticing her behavior, and then she would sort of course correct.
Exactly.
And all of that contributed to you giving her the benefit of the doubt.
Yes. And I think she was very good at figuring out what people like needed, like what made them tick. And she kind of would, I feel like sometimes when she would push the boundary in that way, she was sort of learning where the edge was so that she could figure out what she needed to do to keep the closeness there, is my guess.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, because you could say that she's unaware, right? But actually, she's deeply aware, because despite the kind of abrupt and sometimes entitled throwaway comments, when she sensed that someone who was in her purview might be changing, almost shifting, mm-hmm. she was so aware that she could quickly change back to keep you or anyone else where she needed them.
She also had a manner about her that seemed to sort of cut through anything negative that she might actually be doing. So if she was saying something rude or if she was doing something maybe questionable, she would smile or she would giggle. It would seem like a bit of mischievous fun. And it's only later when you look at the behavior, or when I looked at the behavior on paper, that it became so clear to me that so many of her actions were wrapped in this delivery. It relied on her charm. It relied on, you know, her powers of persuasion to be acceptable in the moment.
Toxic people are masterful at turning their bad behavior into a sort of little joke, to be kind of rude with a glint in their eye, right? And narcissistic people care so deeply about what people think of them. So the entitlement, which is rude, has to get delivered in a more palatable way, like with a little giggle. If it's uncomfortable, if their behavior is uncomfortable, it doesn't matter how cute they are when they do it. It's still a problem. In a way, what you're describing is sort of a really natural evolution of a friendship. What I'm hearing, and I believe hearing this and knowing the story, is what happened to you could really have happened to anyone who was in a friendship with her.
I believe that's true. And I know a lot of people would like to tell themselves otherwise. If everybody were immune to this, nobody would ever sort of get wrapped into a relationship like this. And it doesn't necessarily happen in the way that you expect.
And a lot of it's very subtle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it happens over time.
But it does happen over time. It's not like in the first hour you meet the person, they're abrupt and they're brusque with a waiter or something like that there's a process.
And she did the same story through so many different people that whatever I didn't hear from her, I heard from 20 other people in the same social circles. Even when I started to question what was happening, you know, after she owed me this immense amount of money, which I'm sure we'll get to, it was very hard to move forward because every time I thought I had a theory that might work or make sense, somebody else would dispel it. And I couldn't tell what was real and what was false because everybody had misinformation.
What a shame. There is no such thing as Yelp for people. We can go online and find out if a restaurant has good French fries, but we can't always figure out what other people's experience has been with someone. Let me tell you, if we had something like Yelp for toxic people, we would be saving people so much time and heartache. You had said how, had Anna been a man, your relationship with her would have been different. How so?
Being a young woman and having grown up like a young woman, you know, we are taught to be wary of men who swoop in and give lavish gifts or invite you on trips or even just say hello. Like, I'm always questioning, like, what is your motive here? Are you hitting on me? Are you, you know, checking me out? Like, you have a different way of sort of interpreting behavior based on an agenda. And with friendship, it had never occurred to me to use that same sort of standard for judging behavior based on where someone's coming from.
Friendships with toxic people are so, so tricky. We may be more sensitive to red flags when we're actually dating someone, but so many people will cut friendships, new friendships, more slack. And that can be a real problem when you're dealing with a toxic person. It's something that, you know, struck me in what you've talked about, written about, is also that there was this almost admiration of Anna making it in a man's world, right?
Yeah, I admired that she was a young woman who had the ambition to go up in these traditionally male-dominated spaces and vie for a seat at the table. And I definitely did admire that. I didn't realize it was lacking sort of a moral ballast, but I admired her guts.
Do you feel that admiration, just feeling like, wow, she's really making it in this really difficult and a high end of this, you know, finance and all this real estate and all this other stuff she was doing. Do you think that that might also have led you to cut her some slack?
I think not so much that she was making it, but that she was trying, absolutely. You know, I wanted her to succeed. She was my friend. I believed in her ambition, even if I didn't believe in every one, I could see that she was working towards something, but I was rooting for her.
My session with Rachel will continue after this break.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
...tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. ...that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
Same old us. Oh,
yeah. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
So in the show Inventing Anna, especially, a lot of people were sitting there saying Rachel got into this relationship frivolously, but that's not the case. So can we break down the traits and behaviors that were starting to come out in Anna that you observed and that gave you pause?
The show definitely gets more wrong than it gets right. That person has my name, but there's little else I would say that it resembles the truth of my experience. Anna didn't buy me clothes. She didn't buy me accessories. What first pulled me in was the boldness, the ambitions, the fun. She was very entertaining. She made me laugh. She had a way of framing the world that made sense and this very twisted kind of logic, but it was certainly not how I thought. And there's something about that sort of contrast that was transfixing. Our friendship was fairly fast. I knew her for a year. I saw her, you know, being entitled, being sort of insensitive, not being mindful in big ways and small of the way that what she said or did affected other people. She would play to, I think, this big sister impulse I have. I kept sort of chalking up certain social behavior to seeming like maybe she was like under-socialized. Maybe she didn't have somebody teach her that, like, that's just rude. And I kept wanting to sort of help her.
Oh, the contrast, right? Between being bold and ambitious and fun and entertaining against entitlement and being insensitive and unaware of her impact on others. It's really confusing. So what do? We justify. And justification is how narcissistic people get away with so much bad behavior. We will tend to focus on their good stuff. We rationalize their bad stuff. And it gets so dangerous when we try to rescue or help them. Because that is when a toxic person smells blood on the water and recognizes that now they have a soft target. When do you think you started connecting the dots to seeing that this is something that hangs together? This is actually a personality style. Maybe this person is even narcissistic or something. When did the dots start forming a picture that showed you something that was a bit more concerning and that you were willing to name it that way?
It's funny. It took me a very painfully long time. Mm-hmm. I had every reason to understand in theory what a personality type looks like. Not only do I have psychologist parents, but I also I studied English literature and I know that's not psychology, but I've made a study of characters. Like I've seen them play out in films and in books. And like, that's part of what drew me to working at Vanity Fair in the first place, was a love for characters, was a love for storytelling. And I think that subconsciously, maybe that pulled me into the friendship because she was this larger than life kind of character.
So it's a tough life lesson. And it is so interesting, though, too, that you have this love for English literature. In some ways that might have damned you a little bit.
Oh, totally.
Right. In literature, the character could be written so eloquently that a good writer can actually put the character in the round and in some ways can really make a very compassionate narrative around someone who's quite narcissistic. You know, let's face it. We know your story. She's a con artist. And what a con artist does is that they draw you into a behavior or into doing things on a false assumption. Mm-hmm. And in essence, they really indoctrinate you. And like you said, it's a process. It doesn't happen over one time. It happens over time. For example, her not paying you back, but living as though she had the resources to do so, which created a false security that this will be fine.
Sure.
And what it sounds like she did, and something you've also talked about, is she weaponized your trust and she weaponized your empathy. Does that ring true?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that, I think, has to do with, in this story in particular, the distraction of money and flashy things. I think people look at sort of a net outcome and think, well, you're fine, therefore you're not a victim, whatever.
Narcissistic people are so good at shiny things. We make a lot of assumptions about them. They're successful and they're well put together. And let's face it, superficiality and materialism just by themselves, maybe that's a pink flag. But when we add in other patterns like entitlement and being abrupt with people, and then those flashy, shiny things show up, that's when we need to sit up and pay attention. You know, you said something so smart. I've heard you say this, that someone like Anna, someone who is a con person, they sort of get you to use your own arm against yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because basically, it's sort of the way they play the game is that ultimately, you're acting in your own con, is how you had framed it.
I think that is what con artists and just sort of manipulative people do best, is they tell stories and they ask you to place your trust in them. You know, how much confidence do you have in me? And they sort of, they almost make it like a dare. You know, they make it like a, here, you say this, then this, or why wouldn't you do this? Because X, Y, Z. They sort of shift your perspective of reality in a way that makes decisions that you wouldn't normally make feel like the only decision to make. They just have a way of sort of warping a perspective on something that makes you not complicit. I don't think it makes you guilty. You play a more active role in the kind of orchestration of whatever turns out to be built on a false premise.
But it's built on a false premise. That's the key.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of leads into this next issue, because this one I feel very strongly about, too. This story is a lot about, we can talk about blaming the victim. We can talk about it pathologizing the victim. That's how I see it. Too many people have looked at this story and have portrayed you as the person who took advantage of a situation. But when we bring this down to brass tacks, it was her behavior that was illegal, unethical, and manipulative.
Yeah.
And yet the pathologization of the person who survived the story is something that was happening all the time. What was your experience of that?
I mean, that is always hard. That will never not be hard because it is so twisted. And I think there are a lot of hard things to process in the world, but being misunderstood is, I think, a really tough thing to swallow. When people condemn the victim, they're saying, you had it coming. It's also ironic that, like, I was the one in debt. Like, Amex protected me 2 years later. The Inventing Anna showmakers rearranged a timeline to say that I got protected before the trial, which isn't true. And even if it was, it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that the crime didn't happen. Point being, like, I think it's very, like, twisted, I'd say, that a lot of sort of the people around Anna in real life who are still standing by her side condemn me for being an opportunist when I was the only one who was stuck holding, you know, $62,000. So it's too convenient, and it doesn't really make any, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
There's this sort of double abuse that a person experiences when they've been harmed by a con woman. And then they see that people are actually standing by the con woman and painting the victim, the person who was harmed by that person, as the problem. And this is where we see the power of the enabler when it comes to these kinds of toxic relationships. I mean, listen, the manipulation, the gaslighting, all the rest of it, that's bad enough. But then to watch people prop the manipulator up, that can be just as difficult for so many survivors of these situations. We will be right back with my conversation with Rachel, where she breaks down the infamous trip to Morocco.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So when Anna needed to leave the United States to reset her visa waiver in 2017, she had the suggestion to take a trip to somewhere warm. And it evolved from something that was close by and affordable that I assumed I would obviously pay my share for into, hey, I've booked a private villa at the world's most luxurious hotel in Marrakesh, Morocco. Who should we invite? So it snowballed. It wasn't presented as an all-expenses-paid vacation to sunny Marrakesh. It's funny looking back. It's like, well, how could you have gone in that and not known? I had no idea that a trip could cost $62,000 in the span of a week, for starters. Mm-hmm. Second of all, I had no idea it would cost that much. And there's so many like subtleties and nuances in real life that get completely glossed over when you look at something backwards. Anna framed it as a business expense because she was working towards the creation of this foundation, but she framed this as a research trip. And when it's your friend, I kind of was trying to be supportive. I understood that maybe there would be some degree of research. She wanted to factor in some sort of international cuisine and hospitality and food and beverage components to this foundation. So it became this much bigger ordeal than I had initially expected.
Yeah.
The hotel we stayed at in Marrakesh was called La Mamounia. It's the site of a former palace. It's a walled garden with sprawling villas and a central building that has four restaurants in it. It was beautiful. I kind of always cringe at describing, yes, it was razzle-dazzle and beautiful. And it just, I think there are so many distracting elements when it comes to this story. And a lot of them have to do with razzle-dazzle and money. And it's not to say that that's not important. I think that's the reason that people are paying attention to this story, for better or for worse, because this kind of a thing happens every day, but yeah, it's just not as glamorous as this one looks from the outside looking in. But I think focusing too much on the material grandeur of it all detracts from the fact of, you know, very self-serving Machiavellian behavior at the expense of everybody around Anna, and sort of real betrayals of confidence.
You know, some of this feels like love bombing. When we think about love bombing, we think about, you know, romantic relationships usually, right? But the bells and the whistles and the razzle dazzle, they're distracting. Or at least a narcissistic person hopes they're distracting. It doesn't matter what kind of relationship it is.
I just think the misbehavior gets really overshadowed by the glamour of it all. I remember, though, it sort of started to slip into almost like a business bossiness kind of attitude as we geared towards the trip. Obviously, she was still a friend to me, but it felt a little bit more like she kept asking me to do favors mm-hmm. and kind of like, oh, well, if I can't have you as a friend, I'm going to start bossing you around kind of way because you're going on this trip.
You know, Rachel, I'm really glad that you use this word Machiavellian because it's such an important and it's also a confusing red flag. A Machiavellian person is a very manipulative person who has a goal, right? And a goal they have to reach and they will do anything they need to do, including throwing other people under the bus to get to that goal. Now, in this case, it was about more than just making this trip to Morocco happen. The end game was that this was the kind of life that she felt entitled to. And it's actually kind of chilling for any of us to consider that a person can view us as nothing more than a tool to get what they need.
And I, at the time, didn't see this. I just thought, yeah, like, obviously, if you're going to invite me on this, like, luxurious trip, I'm going to do everything I can to help. That's also what I did professionally. I booked travel and managed logistics. So it felt much easier for me to do than it did for someone like Anna, who was often kind of disorganized and aloof, at least ostensibly. So it's the day we're supposed to leave for Marrakesh. The trainer and the videographer are both texting me, like, what time is our flight? Like, what is going on? Because Anna's confirmed everybody, but she has not sent out any ticket information. So I'm put in this, like, position of being, like, the Anna whisperer and having to liaise. Anna's like, oh, I don't know what time I'm going to be done with meetings here. Like, just take this card. So she's like, book the tickets. She's like, I can't do it. Can you help? So I go on Kayak. I book the cheapest tickets I possibly can. And it seems like her cards go through. I just remember getting a text from her, like, the bank just called me. It was, you know, I can't get a hold of anybody. Like, the transaction was blocked. I was like, well, I'll just put it on mine. And she was like, if that's okay, I can wire you next week. So it started with the flights, and then it became sort of in for a penny, in for a pound. Once she owed me that amount of money, Anna accidentally checked her wallet at the airport, which I know screams red flag today. At the time, it was not beyond the fabric of her character, which was always kind of erratic, mm-hmm. always kind of doing stupid things like forgetting her credit cards. I could rationalize it. I understand that is a red flag, which is why I'm quick to point it out. But here we are. And then it became meals added to the tab.
So the distractibility, the being disorganized, the chaos. You know, those are also red flags, too. And if you are any kind of a rescuer and you also happen to be an organized person, it can really be a setup for someone to step in and try to feel useful in one of these relationships.
It started to be this little bit by bit trickle, like death by paper cuts, tabulating of debt. But then the hotel itself escalated in a very different way. That was not a loan I consented to. Over the course of the week, I'd say halfway in, I noticed Anna was being pulled aside by managers at the hotel who wanted to speak with her. I didn't give it much thought because as far as I had seen or as far as I knew, everything was settled with the hotel in advance. She had forwarded me a booking confirmation that had a credit card, last four digits on file, except my last full day in Marrakesh. I was like, Anna, these people are here. Like, you need to go talk to them. There's something going on. She goes out to talk to them. I, like, go back to the room thinking she's settling it. And when I come back out into the living room, Anna is sitting there. Her phone is just flat on the coffee table. These two men are standing there. They're not the Inventing Anna show has them with, like, guns being violent. And, like, that's not how this was. But they were stern. They were not leaving. But I think what was the most alarming was certainly not the men. It was Anna. She just completely disconnected from the seriousness of the situation. She did not seem to comprehend danger or risk or urgency. She just seemed totally cool, totally calm, totally annoyed. And it was such a puzzling thing to walk into. They looked to me and they're like, we just need a functioning credit card. Like, the bill will be settled upon checkout. And she's like, can we just use yours for now? And I just did not see an alternative, you know, especially in the urgency of the moment. And believing this person was still my friend, I just did not see another solution. Mind you, again, I did not know the cost of that trip, nor did I know my credit card could support that kind of a debt, nor did I know that debt would be going on my credit card. There are so many things that we know now that I didn't know then, but the day just unraveled from there. And by the time I left the next morning, I landed in France and got a text from Anna that said, like, the hotel manager is sending you a receipt. Thank you so much. I'll wire you $70,000 to make sure everything's covered. And I felt so many different emotions all at once in that second. That was the first time I understood how expensive the trip was. So I was kind of racked with this strange gratitude and shock because I still don't fully understand how someone spends that much money in so little time.
Rachel, one point you bring up when retelling this story is how people focus on the grandeur of it all, but you feel that focusing on the grandeur distracts from the real story. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. I mean that at its heart, this is a story about, you know, the making and breaking of our friendship. We came together fast as friends, spent a lot of time together, went on this grand trip, and it was beautiful and it was fun. But it's also why I think people tend to miss the point, because it's easy to sort of bask in the Gossip Girl quality. Or even looking at the Inventing Anna show itself, this like multi-million-dollar production with front row fashion seats and exotic yachts and jets, like it's sugarcoating something that at its core is very rotten.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it really did distract attention. And you also mention how what was most alarming to you was how disengaged Anna was when things really started falling apart. What did it feel like to be with her disengagement? How did you make any sense of it?
It was panic-inducing because there wasn't sense to be made of it. When the men showed up in our villa and were demanding payment, it was very obvious that they were not going anywhere and that this conflict had reached a head. She would make herself to be the victim. Like, why are they bothering me with this? Like, I've already dealt with it. You know, excuses. The lack of panic, the lack of recognition when it came to the urgency of the situation, that's what caused me to take on her panic for her and to sort of internalize the danger in a different way. Because I felt like I was the only one aware of it.
Something that's so unsettling in toxic people is how, in some cases, a person is willing to let everyone else take on the messes and the chaos that they've caused. They just sort of coolly sit back, disengage, and let other people clean up the mess. If you're a rescuer, if you're someone who wants to fix things, you may find yourself trying to clean up the mess you didn't make. And they are definitely counting on that. So the plan was you were paying for it. I mean, in essence, the egocentricity is that there's no danger for me, so there's no danger for anyone.
It's true.
And that was sort of how that was playing out. Why were you so confident that she would pay you back?
I still believed that she was who she said she was. I believed she was having a falling out with her family. I believed that she was disorganized and had overspent some kind of allowance. I believed, though, in part because she was living in hotels full time, regardless of whether we were in Morocco or New York.
What I'm hearing is it was plausible. I mean, it was absolutely plausible, yeah, living as she did. And she had paid you some things back in the past. It sort of set this tone. And so what then became the breaking point of realizing that this was actually a con and that led you to go to the authorities?
A $62,000 balance on my credit cards and no clear sign of reimbursement being on the way, despite constant reassurances. It was this extreme disconnect between words and actions, you know, false promises, like talking in circles, moving the goalposts. For every 10 questions asked, getting maybe one answer, and it still didn't give me any actual clarity.
So here we see a classical form of manipulation, making false promises, which is something called future faking. Then there is the talking in circles, which is something that's called word salad. Talking, but not really making any real sense. And then also not answering the question, which is really a form of gaslighting. We go into this next piece. Anna is now getting more famous and reinventing herself. What is it like for you to see her sort of succeed in this way and to see people get behind her despite her conduct?
There are a lot of things I feel about that. Most of them aren't personal. It's kind of frustrating at this point to be talking about this story because in life, like, I am happy, healthy. Like, I don't think about Anna very much. You know, it's really not about her and me anymore, but I am speaking because I do think this is indicative of a sort of bigger picture issue with the way that our culture tends to reward narcissistic individuals who are larger than life, and they captivate us because they're entertaining and they say whatever they want and they make these weird promises or they
do these quirky things or they act in these like really bold, audacious ways. What I make of it looking at it now, it's like my takeaway from this is that, you know, what I gave to Anna was my attention. I say the stakes were low and it was frivolous, but I gave her my time. And that's not without value. That's how our behavior is influenced. That's how our view of the world is influenced.
Like you said, our attention is a resource. And when we give it away, the story gets to stay alive. I watched this story and I said, oh my goodness, like this is just straight up a story of narcissism.
Right.
And on top of that, blaming the individual who came into the narcissistic person's life,
right,
which is what my entire clinical practice is about. So when I saw your story, I actually became incensed.
Thank you. Yeah.
Right? I mean, I thought, what are they doing to this woman? She was harmed by this person.
Yeah.
And we are glorifying in some ways, you know, looking at the con with some grudging admiration versus all of us are vulnerable to this story. All of us.
Yeah.
And anyone who thinks they're not, they couldn't be conned like this is going to get conned, to be frank with you.
Yeah.
If anyone was that arrogant, right? This takes me to this next question is that I think one of the struggles in this question, and like you said, they didn't even get the time frame right. For 2 years, you had to sit with that credit card, you know, bill hanging over your head and that lack of resolution. But now we're telling the story at its end. And it seems like since you got the money back and your book was successful, it's as though people are telling you, Rachel, you don't have the right to feel hurt.
Yeah, it's like resilience is like antithetical to victimhood somehow.
Right. And so I think that the piece that I struggle with is that you don't get to have a feeling. And that to me, that piece is really, really messed up.
Yeah.
Because the behavior you saw, right? The behavior you saw, the entitlement, the grandiosity, and I will argue lack of empathy. She didn't have empathy for you. You were an instrument. All of you were in this story of hers. The arrogance, the constant need for validation. I mean, this is like narcissism 101 to me. There's no other way to see this. And also the other ways that you were gaslighted. Your reality was doubted on regularly. And then she became very vindictive. And that vindictiveness to me was the icing on the cake. That in romantic relationships, we talk about something called post-separation abuse. But I would argue that the point at which the friendship sort of cleaved off, she went at it with the same vindictiveness as, for example, an angry narcissistic partner would in a romantic relationship.
Yeah, that all rings true. And I think the way that the Netflix showmakers approached it in that television show, that's part of why I chose to speak up, just because I think it does an injustice to anybody who's been through a relationship like that.
Yeah.
And like I said, like this story has gotten attention for all kinds of reasons. Since I have a platform and people will listen, like I feel like I have a responsibility to speak up because I do understand what's happened here. And the gaslighting, I learned hard. I didn't know at first. I learned. I read things. I tried to understand what had happened. I tried to, you know, I wrote so that I could look at the events on paper and try and figure out, what did I miss? What, like, where is my responsibility? Where, you know, where was I wronged? Like, how can I learn from this, whatever, like, and come away from it with a better understanding of people and myself?
We often think of gaslighting as one person to one person. Not only were you gaslighted by one person, then you were gaslighted by a system,
right,
and then honestly gaslighted by the world. And I can't think of anything more psychologically destabilizing, Rachel, than going through that. Because I have a real problem with this idea of, okay, sure, I'll meet you halfway on that one, Rachel. Bunch of privileged people doing privileged things in privileged settings, sure. All great.
Yeah.
But the feelings you had were real. I don't care how privileged the story was. That was real.
I agree.
That was real hurt.
Yeah. Thank you.
There's a real cruelty.
Yeah.
Forget individual narcissism. Honestly, the story you shared
speaks
of almost narcissism on a societal level. And that's really concerning to me.
I'm with you. Thank you for giving it voice because I feel that way. But I think having been through this for however many years, like process after process, just acknowledging privilege doesn't mean that it makes anything okay. I don't say that to undermine the fact that the stress was very real, that the repercussions were very real, that the betrayal of trust was very, like, it was all very real. I just think I've been through so many different iterations of this that I've come to realize that anything I say can and will be picked apart by people who are looking for reasons to blame me. And
correct,
to some extent, that has nothing to do with me at the end of the day.
But at the end of the day, too, though, Rachel, shaming you puts all future victims at risk. That's where I struggle with. Like, okay, go ahead. You want to shame her, shame her. But what that does is everybody else then who feels that, A, if I come forward with any kind of story like this, people are going to shame me and I'm too scared to, so I'm going to have to put up and shut up.
Yeah.
And that is a really dangerous paradigm. So it is so important. And I know it must be hard after all these years, because it sounds like you've moved forward. And having gone through this, and since my life is thinking and talking and musing over narcissism and psychopathy, do you have any questions for me after having gone through this experience?
Just like, do you see an antidote, I guess, to this sort of like toxic spread of not only celebrating, but rewarding this kind of behavior and personality type?
A show like Inventing Anna, the way the story sort of played out in the media, all of that, that actually makes me feel more pessimistic. Because when I saw how quick people were to glorify the con, I thought, of course they're here. And of course their partner did this to them because they feel incentivized to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the antidote is something that is so, it feels impossible. I mean, it really is paying empathy forward. But the problem is, if empathy is weaponized, that's an issue. When we see a case like you went through with the individual who engaged in this behavior, I see absolutely no likelihood of change. I mean, that's what the research literature would tell us too, that somebody who's so resolute in their lack of remorse and their belief they did nothing wrong, there's no way you're going to see any form of change there. So at the individual level, there's not likely to be an antidote. At the societal level, we're going to have to switch up our game entirely. But as long as this stuff is clickbait, as long as this stuff gets eyes and views and virality and money, it's conversations like this to say, okay, everyone, I looked at your story and said, I could have been conned easily.
Yeah.
And I got really worried that everyone who's so arrogantly saying, I wouldn't have gotten played, I said, oh, wow, then that means you're going to be the next one who's going to get played by a narcissist, because at least I have the humility to know I can and I have been and I likely will be played again. And I think that that humility is where we get resolve, and that resolve is where we learn to set boundaries and be more discerning.
Yeah.
And I think that discernment then, Rachel, becomes the key. And yours is also an interesting story too, Rachel. Ironically, the solid beginning you had, loving parents, consistent loving, you know, history with your family, close-knit family, and then really good friendships, in a way, you're not even prepared for this. So I don't know if we have to put everyone in sort of toxic summer camp so they can learn this once and then go back to healthiness. But what it did do was give you resilience to be able to grow past this.
My mom and dad will thank you for that. And I agree.
Yeah, well, they did. I think that the fact that you had a safe place to land in a way meant that your likelihood of connecting the dots into Anna as someone manipulative and cruel that needed to be walked away from, in fact, it went another direction, that this was somebody where you could actually meet them with empathy. You could actually reach a hand out to the bully, as it were, which I think in concept is beautiful, but in practice is dangerous.
Boundaries are important.
Boundaries are everything.
I think that ironically, that same sort of safety net, or, you know, the healthy upbringing that led to resilience, and that combined with like working as a producer and always looking for creative solutions to complex problems, it's what allowed me to figure out, you know, book dealer XYZ before I went to trial, which I think is part of why people didn't see me as a victim, because I had already managed to find resilience. And I think that is hard for most people to relate to.
Share with us, Rachel, what are you working on now, and how can people support you in the work that you're doing?
I wouldn't ask anything of anybody. I appreciate anyone who's listening to this, and I wish you the best if you're going through something similar. And I appreciate curiosity and the desire to look deeper into something that at its surface may present as one thing, and at its core actually involves a lot more nuance than initially meets the eye.
Again, I thought your book was really fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. In fact, I had watched the series. I was like, eh. Then I read your book and I was like, wow, this is what I was looking for, which is a far more clear telling of the story. So, you know, I think people who haven't read it, I highly recommend your book. And I also thank you for elevating this story to the place of friendship. We talk about narcissism in families. We talk about narcissism in romantic relationships, but we don't talk about it in friendships. And I think that's a big mistake, because friendships are often really defining relationships, especially for younger people, people in their 20s and 30s, and can be just as impactful as any intimate relationship, and really impactful in some cases. So I think that sometimes we give friends a freer pass than we might give other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your story is a reminder that these kinds of toxic personality patterns can really do harm in any human relationship, whether it's a romantic relationship or a friendship.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for giving it the space as well.
Absolutely. Here are my final thoughts from my conversation with Rachel. Be aware that the very best part of you, your empathy, unfortunately, can actually make you a target. Yes, be empathic, but catch yourself when you justify other people's behavior. All of us have to stop glorifying con people, con men, con women, con anyone. And we must stop blaming the victim. Because when you do that, when you blame the victim, you really actually set yourself up for more self-shame when a narcissistic relationship happens to you. And inevitably, it will happen to you. None of us are safe from toxic relationships. Whether you're from a happy family, a messed up family, or a family that's sort of in between, manipulation always plays on our trust, our core wounds, and our insecurity. We have to remember that cynical is not a bad word, and all of us need to let people earn our trust instead of just handing it over. Thank you so much for listening. Lastly, make sure you subscribe on iHeartRadio and please rate this podcast on Apple Podcasts. This show was produced by executive producers Jada Pinkett Smith, Fallon Jethro, Ellen Rakitin, and Dr. Romani Dervasala. Also, producer Matthew Jones, associate producer Mara Della Rosa, and our editors and sound engineers, Devin Donahue and Calvin Bailiff.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.